This is the Oanda Podcast, brought to you by Jazz FM's Business Breakfast.
Welcome back to the Oanda Market Insights Podcast, brought to you with the Jazz FM Business Breakfast. I'm Johnny Hart. Each week, I'm joined by Oanda Senior Market Analyst Craig Erland to review the stories that made the business and market headlines, as well as look forward to the business week ahead. And it's hello once again to Craig Erland. I hope you had a very good Easter.
Yeah, it was very nice. It was very relaxing. How about yours?
It wasn't relaxing. It was a break, though. It was a break. I won't go into that now. It has been a short but topsy-turvy week for markets. What was your market moment of the week?
Well, the market moment of the week is, again, it happened on Wednesday. It does relate to an older story. But we did see quite a remarkable turnaround in the markets on Wednesday. We had a negative start in the European session. You were looking at the US futures to see what kind of an open we were going to get on Wall Street. And the Dow was down 550 points, which equates to around 2.5%. So it's quite a substantial move pre-market. And this came on the back of China announcing that they will be making or introducing retaliatory tariffs against the US amounting to around $50 billion, which is a number which people will be familiar with because that's the number that the US had touted as the value of the tariffs which are being imposed on China. The interesting thing about the Chinese tariffs was that it was clear from them that they were targeting Trump himself. They were targeting the Republicans ahead of the midterm elections. So they were focusing on things like soybeans. They were focusing on the agricultural sector. Areas of the US that voted for Trump in 2016, big swing states in the US, basically saying to Trump and the Republicans, if you're going to follow through on this, we will punish you where it matters to you. And that is in the midterm elections in Congress. And the response from Trump and his team was as you'd expected. They were very angry at these attempts by China, saying that they're going after legitimate competing industries, which is not what the US is doing. But it shows from China's perspective that they're taking this very seriously. And they're saying to the US, if you're going to try and push us around, we'll go toe-to-toe with you. We will not back down on this issue. This should be resolved diplomatically rather than with the threat of a trade war, rather than trying to push around people who you've previously tried to make people believe are your friends or are going to be friends in the long run. And this is where this is going. This is why a trade war is a legitimate fear, because ultimately, if we are going to continue down this path, and the noises we've heard in the last couple of days from Trump would suggest they are, he's already talking about another $100 billion in tariffs, and China again today has said similar. This is very negative, and that's why the markets were trading down on Wednesday. But then we had these comments from Larry Kudlow, who's an economic advisor in the White House, and he downplayed the tariffs. He suggested that it'll be at least a couple of months before they come in, that negotiations could take place in the meantime, and made it perfectly clear that despite Trump's threats of a trade war, despite the fact that he claims they're very easy to win, which is currently proving not right now, Trump doesn't necessarily have the support behind him for an actual trade war to commence. Really, what the US wants and what the White House wants, or at least what people around the White House want, is negotiations to try and make a deal and make trade with China more fair. And this has given the market a little bit of hope. And we saw a dramatic turnaround in the markets in response to that. And markets actually opened higher, or were higher shortly after they opened, and ended the session 1% higher. Like, this is quite a significant turnaround in the markets.
It's very much the art of the deal, according to the title of Trump's autobiography, isn't it? This is a starting point for Trump. But it's very interesting what you say about the Rust Belt and how China are targeting those midterm election voters, because we've got the backdrop of this alleged involvement of Russia in the presidential election. And from a global point of view, what's interesting is how these massive nations are actually using a sort of electoral ploys to actually get their own way to a certain extent.
They are. They're being very strategic. And when we were talking about steel and aluminium tariffs in Europe, it's not surprising that the European Union was taking a very similar stance when it was planning its own counter-tariffs. It was looking at politically sensitive and politically important areas for Trump when proposing counter tariffs. So Trump may be saying he's going after looking after the aluminium and steel industries. It may be saying that he is looking at intellectual property and ways to protect this. But that doesn't mean other countries are going to respond in kind. They are more likely to want to go for things that will prevent this beginning and prevent tariffs in total, as opposed to looking so as strategically as Trump is at specific areas like that. Everyone has their own motives, and clearly China's, like Europe's, is to avoid a trade war altogether, whereas Trump is to appease a voter base that voted for him on the impression that he was going to take on China while doing no harm to the US economy in the process, which is effectively what he promised.
But despite the threat of further tariffs against China from Trump, as you mentioned, $100 billion is the latest, markets are a little bit more optimistic because, as you say, they're seeing this as a negotiating process.
Exactly. And I think that's the point that Larry Kudlow is trying to get across, that this is a negotiation and the end goal is hopefully going to be a reduced deficit, which I do think it's what Trump wants. The problem, I think, is that while Trump ultimately wants to use this as a negotiating tactic, this is much more hostile and confrontational than a number of these countries are used to. And Xi Jinping in China can't be seen to being bullied and pushed around by Donald Trump. He is the leader of the world's second largest economy. The European Union can't be seen to being pushed around and forced to do something against their wishes by Donald Trump. And while this has maybe worked for him in the past, from a business perspective, he decides what he wants and he will do whatever it takes to get it. Now, he is leading the world's largest and arguably most important country, and he needs to also act with a little bit of responsibility. And while I think the issue that people have is they don't believe that the Republicans would follow through. The problem is, do people really believe that Trump won't follow through? And I personally, and I think a number of people feel this way, he will not back down on this because he will see that as weakness. So he will continue to ramp it up and ramp it up and ramp up the pressure in the hope that eventually China will back down. And that's a big concern because I'm not necessarily convinced China will back down.
Sort of immovable forces working against each other. And you're absolutely right. It's not in the psychology of President Trump to back down, but nor in President Xi either.
No, it's not, especially when they know they can really punish the Republicans in November. So as far as I'm concerned, this will have to be resolved behind the scenes and both sides will have to try and claim a victory in this, because if this continues until November, I think it will really hurt the Republicans in some very important states. And if the Republicans were to lose their majority in the House and in the Senate, as happened to the Democrats in the past, what you end up with is a president and a Congress that can't get anything done because they can't agree
stalemate.
On anything.
Yeah.
You get a stalemate.
Yeah, indeed. Let's stay with the United States, Craig, and those non-farm payroll figures. US job growth slowed sharply in March as employers added just 103,000 positions over the month. That was smaller than expected. The unemployment rate remains unchanged at just over 4%. Analysts have said that the cold weather may have contributed to the slowdown, which was anticipated to some degree after those massive gains in February. But maybe this economy is a victim of its own success, because we've got massive amounts of employment now, and maybe there's a problem with the number of people who are available to work.
Well, I think I agree with absolutely everything you've just said. Yes, this is a weaker number. I think weather did contribute to it, and there's plenty of evidence in data that we've seen, not just from the US, but from the UK and Europe as well, that suggests the March weather contributed to a slowdown. We've seen it from the PMI figures, the surveys which we've had over the last week, all of which have noted the weather and the impact that that's had on these industries.
Those so, dastardly Russians.
Exactly. They're at it again. They're at it again. Yeah, I mean, there's plenty of evidence to suggest the weather has impacted the economy in March in Europe, the UK, the US. So there's no reason not to believe that it's infected employment in March as well. It was a big miss from what was expected, but then we did see, as you say, strong employment growth in February. It was 313,000 reported initially. I think that was revised up today to around 324,000. Ultimately, though, and this is the other point that you made, how important is it how many jobs we get created every single month? We're being told there's not much slack in the US economy, so typically you would expect job creation to slow down. Instead of new jobs being created, you're seeing people move between jobs, and this is what happens in a tightening labour market, and this is why wages typically grow in that market. So you'd expect job creation to slow down, but what we're not seeing, and this is the concerning thing, is wage growth picking up too significantly. It jumped up from 2.6 to 2.7% today. That was in line with expectations. That's still far short of what we were seeing prior to the financial crisis. It's still a conundrum for the Federal Reserve, because the Federal Reserve are talking about the fact that we've got a tight labour market, but they are confused about the fact that we've not got wage growth or inflation.
You say that's a concerning thing, but surely it would mean that we've got less likely an opportunity for the Fed to raise rates quite as often or quite as much as we first thought.
Yes, but the Fed has shown already that it's willing to raise interest rates in anticipation of wage growth and inflation, and it's not necessarily going to wait for it. And I think, really, ultimately, the difference between a third and a fourth rate hike this year or next isn't going to make a massive difference. But if they are doing so because the labour market is proven to be tightening, and we're doing so because wages are growing and inflation is picking up, then that's a positive, because people always naturally, right now, particularly post-2008, people seem to associate rate hikes as being a negative. But typically, we have to remember that rate hikes generally occur in an economy that is growing, that's healthy, and that requires rate hikes to stop it overheating. So it's typically a good thing. The problem that we've got right now is, since the financial crisis, we've had a decade now of very, very low interest rates. So a lot of people aren't used to a tightening environment. Another problem we've got is that the US is seeing interest rates rise at a time when wages aren't growing, so people feel worse off. In the UK, we're talking about an interest rate rise when the economy is slowing and wages aren't growing. And in Europe, there is now starting to be talk of a rate hike in 2019 at a time when Germany's performing perfectly well. And overall, the economy in the EU, in the euro area, is performing okay. But the economy of Italy, of Spain, of Greece and others isn't at the point when rate hikes are necessarily appropriate. So this is why rate hikes are suddenly deemed to be a negative thing, because it just doesn't feel like the right time.
It's funny, hasn't it? We don't really talk about those Mediterranean economies very much anymore, although they are on a tightrope, really, and still recovering from the big recession 10 years ago.
They very much are, and some are doing better than others. Spain in particular has been highlighted over the last couple of years as one that's doing much, much better. But they're doing better from a much lower base. Yeah. Unemployment is still extremely high in Spain. Youth unemployment is still extremely high in Spain. These countries are nowhere near what would be defined as healthy. They're nowhere near what would be defined as a tightening labour market, which would usually what would accompany higher interest rates. So that's the concern for people right now. And that's why it's important that these central banks do approach this very gradually and very cautiously. And I do think the Fed's actually done a very good job. Interest rates have risen gradually, and they've now got themselves to a point where if inflation doesn't appear, that they can afford to take the foot off the gas. If we've got another recession, they've got room to manoeuvre to cut interest rates again. And there's been no evidence that the current rate hikes have done any harm to the economy. Other countries have to follow suit and approach it in an equally cautious way. If we do see higher inflation and higher wage growth in the US, then the Fed will probably progress along a path similar to what it's already anticipating, and people are okay with that. I guess what people are looking at from these figures is, if it shows that we're still getting no inflation and we're still getting no wage growth, maybe, as per the last jobs report would suggest, there's more slack in the labour market than the Fed has been calculating, then they may take the foot off the gas a little bit, but they have afforded themselves the ability to do so based on the actions they've taken over the past couple of years.
It's been a short working week in the UK, of course. The retail figures were obviously going to be bad because of the beast from the east, and we're going to have more data like that coming out over the next couple of weeks, aren't we? Because we're still recovering from what was a terrible month.
I think it's months like these that we can't read too much into the data, and
exactly.
I think that's always worth pointing out. And there's another thing that's worth noting is these surveys are very volatile. And they are very, they react very strongly to very recent events. And so when you would look at GDP, you would look at other measures of economic activity, you would typically look at these, especially the ones that are measured year on year, you would typically look at these and you would say, you can see these things gradually fading in, any issues. The PMIs are very, you see a very quick reaction. That's why they're so volatile. So the things like the beast from the east, who knows what impact this trade tariffs story has had on manufacturers, etc., service companies' view on what the outlook actually is. Because if you're a car manufacturer in Germany right now, and you've got Donald Trump openly saying, well, if the EU does these counter tariffs that's been touted, then we're going to go after their car industry. Are you going to be as optimistic about the outlook? Probably not. So maybe that has small impact on the surveys. And when you're already quite negative because of what the weather disruptions and so on and so forth, and also Europe's had its own issues with overcapacity, not overcapacity, but with supply side issues because demand has ramped up so quickly over the recent term, then maybe that just drops the number a little bit, and all of these the build-up of negative factors has a more negative impact than it normally would on these surveys. Next month, when the weather passes and people don't view the threat of a trade war maybe perhaps as being quite significant, then you see a bump back the other way. So I tend to view these figures very much in isolation. I'm very much more focused on the overall trend. And while the overall trend may suggest there's a little bit of a slowdown, it doesn't suggest that there's a bigger slowdown as these particular figures suggest.
You mentioned the US car industry, but we had some figures from the UK industry earlier on. And what was perhaps the most compelling was the massive fall in the number of diesel sales. Not necessarily unexpected, but it was something like 30%, wasn't it?
Yeah, it was. That was one of the key takeaways from that particular report. But we've got to remember, diesel cars have become very unpopular over the last year. The emissions scandal, I don't think, helped that whatsoever. People are becoming a bit more conscious about the environment, and when you're looking at diesel cars and people view them quite clearly as being less environmentally friendly, and there is, if I'm not mistaken, the UK is looking to effectively reduce the number of diesel cars over the next 10 or 20 years.
Well, they'll be outlawed by 2040, along with petrol, actually.
Exactly. Then I think people are naturally moving away from the likes of diesel. It's also worth noting that in these numbers, there was a significant drop overall in car registrations, but that was due to the fact that in March last year, we had a certain vehicle duty coming into play. So people
speeded up their
purchase of these cars to avoid that duty. So whereas it ramped up the numbers this time last year, that by comparison has a very negative impact on this year's figures.
It's been a very difficult period for Facebook, of course, in the wake of the Cambridge Analytica furore. And Mark Zuckerberg is now going to testify to the Senate. He's going to have to perform like he has never done before. This is next week, isn't it?
It is. He's going to testify before the Senate. He's not going to testify before the UK, which is quite interesting. The numbers just keep ramping up for those who have been affected, which must be worrying for him. It's going to be a very, very difficult situation for him. The Facebook stock has been heavily impacted as a result of this particular scandal. You still feel like this is a can of worms which has already just opened. I can't help but be a little bit concerned about these particular stocks that rely heavily on our data and their ability to use it in order to profit. That's not to say that they're all dishonest or that they're all intentionally being dishonest and using it in an incorrect manner or allowing people to use it in an incorrect manner. However, what this Cambridge Analytica story has showed is that what we consider to be information about ourselves, which isn't that important, it can be used not just to market to us, but also to manipulate us. And that's where people have crossed the line. There's a lot of people who seem to be closing their Facebook accounts in protest to what has happened, which means that the actions of Mark Zuckerberg now over the coming months are very important. So I imagine he's going to be extremely well rehearsed for this Senate hearing, because his performance in this could well determine how the Facebook stock reacts over the coming weeks, and how people perceive what he's doing, and whether people believe he's taking enough action and taking this seriously enough in order to prevent it happening again.
The sugar tax. Let's talk the sugar tax. That's come into effect, hasn't it? And it's an interesting development, actually, Craig. I mean, the government is on a sort of win-lose scenario, because the more the drinks companies do about the levels of sugar, the lower the tax take. And in fact, as we were saying off air, the government's already going to take less tax than we first thought. But long term, the effect on, for instance, health and the NHS might put more money into the exchequer.
Exactly. And it's about weighing up the short term benefits, the long term benefits. Ultimately, the point of this is meant to be a deterrent, and it would appear and a deterrent, I should stress, for both the industry but also for people, the cost being the biggest deterrent for people. And we've already seen, for example, in the last year in, I believe it's Mexico, has brought in a similar sugar tax, and I think the amount of sugary drinks purchased fell by 12%, I think it was, in the first year. So clearly the deterrent has worked to an extent in its first year. But it's also meant to be as a deterrent for companies to try and deter them from using as much sugar. And that's one of the biggest impacts that we've seen. So we have seen a number of drinks companies reduce the amount of sugar. Iron Brew, for example, they've cut their sugar by 50% and replaced it with an alternative sweetener, much to the annoyance of, I believe, 512,000 people who signed the petition warning AG Barr to keep their hands off their Iron Brew.
That's quite a sizable number of people.
It is quite a sizable number of people, and that's exactly why Coca-Cola's gone for the alternative route. Coca-Cola has decided we're not going to fiddle with our formula. There's a case from years ago when Coca-Cola tried to fiddle with the formula, and there was a significant backlash.
Coca-Cola Classic.
Exactly. Yeah. There's a significant backlash, and people were complaining about the fact that we are grown-ups, we are adults, we should be able to choose whether we want to drink these sugary drinks or not. So it's interesting to see the different actions that the companies have taken in order to deal with this. Coca-Cola choosing instead to push its Coke Zero and Diet Coke brands and try and encourage more people to have these alternatives while allowing people who want to have the original formula to keep it. It'll be interesting to see in the medium term whether which strategy, I guess, works best, because now it seems, I think, AG Barr have now complied with the numbers, and the 99%, I think, of their drinks are now below the threshold, so they're not going to be paying very much tax at all. Whereas I think Coca-Cola's, based on the forecast, are going to be paying about 45% of the entire tax. It'll be interesting to see which strategy works and whether Coca-Cola decide to go down an alternative route in 2 or 3 years' time, or whether Iron Brew decide to replace the sweeteners with sugar and just pay the tax. I think that's going to be the interesting thing, because people are becoming more health conscious. And while this is an important thing to work towards it, I think other steps are needed as well. On smoking, we went from paying more money for cigarettes, and the price of cigarettes, I don't personally smoke, but I know people who do, and the price of cigarettes have apparently gone up quite considerably over the last 10 years. And now, after that tax, while it was a deterrent, it wasn't enough of a deterrent, and then they went to plain packaging and big warnings on the packet. Are we going down the same route for sugary drinks ultimately? Are we going to see much more warning labels about the health benefits or the health costs of drinking these sugary drinks? And is this just a first step?
Finally, Craig, let's have a brief look at the week ahead. What should we look out for?
Well, I think next week, it's quite a quiet week on the data front, but there are a couple of things which do stand out, one of which is the release of the Fed minutes from March on Wednesday. And I think that will be a keen interest to traders who will remember in March that we had the new economic forecast. They projected 3 interest rate hikes this year still, rather than the potential 4th after tax reforms, but 4 next year rather than 3. So it makes very little difference. The longer term rate being the neutral rate being slightly higher than previously anticipated, again, largely driven by these tax reform measures. So I think there'll be a lot of attention paid to those FOMC minutes. The second thing, which I think is going to be a key focus point for investors next week, is earnings. The US earnings season starts towards the end of next week, so we'll get the likes of JP Morgan reporting their first quarter earnings on Friday. So a lot of attention is going to shift to that. How have these companies performed in the first quarter? But more importantly, what impact did tax reform have on their first quarterly earnings compared to the last quarter when tax reform measures hadn't been introduced yet? We've also got Tesco reporting full year earnings, so I think that will be of interest as well. And then finally, it's just an ongoing story, isn't it? But we can't possibly expect trade wars not to be a key theme once again next week, because ultimately, neither side is backing down. It started off with steel and aluminium, then it was $3 billion in tariffs from China. $50 billion in tariffs from Trump, again from China. And now, yesterday, Trump stating that they're looking to impose $100 billion in for China. And today, the Chinese Commerce Ministry said that they have already prepared countermeasures to this $100 billion. It's not going away anytime soon.
Should be very interesting. And, of course, we'll catch up with you during the week on the Business Breakfast between 6 and 6.30 BST.
Absolutely. Look forward to it.
Thanks for joining us.
The Oanda podcast from the team behind Jazz FM's Business Breakfast, a daily early morning 30-minute briefing for the day ahead. On air from 6 a.m. Listen to Jazz FM on DAB, online, or just ask Alexa.